like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I want to first wish Mike Strauss a happy birthday. He turns 13 today, so may I just say, yikes. My guest today is Joel Rocky, executive director of One Last Treat, a nonprofit founded by a group of veterans whose mission, carried out by veterans who volunteer, is, as they describe it, quote, to provide comfort, compassion, and one last treat to severely at-risk and soon-to-be-passing animals, end quote. This undertaking encompasses an array of efforts, including heading into shelters and adopting animals that are decidedly senior, in many cases are in frail health or near the end of their lives. The prevailing idea is to ensure that these animals aren't suffering alone in a shelter or vet clinic, or to help families who lack the funds to look after their pets' final needs. We'll hear more about One Last Treat and how it got started, how it works, and more when I speak with Joel Rocky in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Later, I'll speak briefly with Sue Pike, who's a Reiki master, intuitive healer and medium, and animal communicator. A frequent visitor to ELOVE's great show Ultrasounds here on WMF Thursday nights. In fact, she'll join ELOVE on air tomorrow night at 10 p.m. as part of a visit to Tampa, where she'll do a variety of Reiki sessions, pet readings, and more. But right now, let's get to Joel Rocky and One Last Treat with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Joel Rocky to Talking Animals. Good morning, Joel.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals this morning.
Absolutely.
So before we explore the world of One Last Treat, I'd like to find out a bit about you, starting with, where are you from? Where did you grow up, Joel?
So I grew up in Hubbardston, Michigan. It's a town right outside of Lansing, Michigan, and just a little village, about 300 people. So I'm originally from Michigan.
And how important were animals to you and your family when you were a kid?
You know what? The interesting thing is as I was growing up, I definitely didn't have this realization that I do now about animals. We had a few animals. I just was never as attached to them as you think I would have been. So it's definitely something that has grown into my life now. But we did have animals growing up. We had some cows and some pigs and a few dogs and cats.
But it just sounds like at that point they were around, but you were sort of indifferent to them?
Yeah, you know, I guess I wasn't developed enough to really understand, you know, emotionally, you know, kind of how they, you know, how they worked.
And then I take it growing up, or at least as you eased into adulthood, mm-hmm. you sort of thought differently about animals.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
How did that happen, or did something kind of trigger something? Was it a catalyst for that, or...?
I'm not 100% sure. I don't know if there was just one specific day that it happened or a time frame, but, you know, as I got out of the military and I got dogs of my own, I think I created a bond with them. I don't know, maybe out of a necessity for something. I don't know.
Yeah.
And once I created that bond, it was, you know, it was just a path I knew I wanted to take, you know, helping animals.
For sure. Well, I want to circle back to that in a moment. But first, just talk to me a little bit about being in the service. When did you go in? How old were you? Some of those details.
I went in when I was 19. Mm-hmm. So I got in there in 2007, and I did just about 5 years. And I went in and I joined the Navy, and I became a corpsman in the Navy, which is a medic. And from there, I got sent with the Marines. And so I did about out of my 5 years, I did about 4.5 years with the Marine Corps. I was stationed at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and I did a tour in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Wow. Okay. So that covered a lot of ground and a couple of different branches of the service as well. So
yeah, it's a little confusing, so I kind of have to explain it. But yeah.
And how does that work, Joel, that you started off in the Navy and then shifted over to the Marines? Yeah. How does that come about?
that's a great question. It's a common question. So the Marines don't have, you can't enlist into the Marine and become Marines and become a medic. You have to join the Navy. So the Navy, you know, gives their medics to the Marines when they need them. So
yeah.
that's how it worked. I went through medic school with the Navy, and the Marines had a need for a medic. And I wanted to go to Spain. I wanted to work in a hospital in Spain. And they said, nope, you're going over with the Marines and you're going to Iraq. So yeah, that's what they did to me. And but it was a great time. In fact, I met my two other buddies who started One Last Treat with me when I got sent over there. So
well, that sounds cool. And we're inching towards One Last Treat. But obviously, you joined the Navy, or at least joined as it sounds like a path, because that's how you could become a medic, which it sounds like was the goal. Although their destination and yours obviously seem to differ.
Yeah.
So given those 5 years, but I guess 4.5 with the Marines and the tour in Iraq, and I guess, and in what ways would you say now, looking back, those experiences change you?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I guess looking back at it now, you just go through it, and, you know, and I mean, not to mention, I mean, the training obviously changes you and changes your mind and kind of your way of thinking, and really instills a, you know, a thought process that you probably didn't have when you were 19 years old and you went in the military. So that's one. And then some of the stuff you just see overseas, you know, when you go to Iraq or Afghanistan and see how these other people are living, and how just a little bit of compassion can help somebody. I mean, that goes a long ways. And I think over time, after doing that so many times and, you know, really realizing that that's something that you're a process of, I mean, every time you go out and you meet somebody who has, you know, just has, you know, in their mind, it's not a terrible life, but in your mind, it is an absolutely terrible life. But they, you know, they don't really necessarily know. And just knowing that you can somehow help that person, definitely, I guess that has probably developed me to where I am now with animals. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
A lot of these animals don't necessarily know that they have a terrible life.
Right.
The way that you perceive it, you say, oh, wow, I could make that life, their life so much better. And I think that's, it's just kind of snowballing. And now I'm doing it with animals and people too as well. But yeah.
Sounds like there was a budding compassion there that maybe really was bloomed more fully when you were.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then what about, I mean, just seeing kind of the way people lived in and around the areas where you were in combat. I mean, what was the actual combat experience? How did that affect you alongside what you just saw about some of the people and their conditions and what they were living in and the so-called terrible life as you describe it?
Yeah. So I guess my biggest thing is, so we were in a sniper platoon. That's where I spent most of my time at when I was with the Marines. And, you know, a lot of our things, we'd go on missions and whatnot. We'd do a lot of, you know, a lot of Overwatch. So we'd watch the people all day and kind of see how their life is, and, the processes of certain families in the villages and stuff. And what I noticed big time is, you know, these people really didn't have any stability. And, you know, as we hear, we have a lot of stability, and, that's just something that, I mean, I think all the guys didn't really understand, you know what I mean? Like, how can these people not have any stability and whatnot? You know, when you're in combat with some of these people, like, some of these people are families that you have watched before that are now are fighting you. You know what I mean? They were once friends, and then now they're fighting you at one point. Mm. And that's, you know, that's in my mind, is because they don't have any stability. They are kind of stuck in between, you know, two groups of people telling them what to do and whatnot. And I feel like if you can find some kind of stability and bring that to a person, I feel like they are able to really, I don't know, kind of live and decide and go down their own path.
And so, Joel, once you got out after the five-year stint there, to what extent did you feel the challenges that veterans often experience in the transition from being in combat to being at home?
Yeah, so when I got out of the military, I actually had about a six-month decompression period, which was pretty good. I was still in the military, but I wasn't necessarily home yet. So that was really good and ideal. A lot of guys get out directly after they go overseas, and they're literally in firefights 3 weeks ago, and now they're out completely of the military. So I had a good transition process. But what I did notice is that little things that never would have bothered me before are now bothering.
For example.
Not so much now. Crowded rooms. I did not like crowded rooms. And me personally, I knew that if I go in a crowded room, I wasn't thinking that people were going to try to attack me or kill me or anything like that. I don't know. I could not stand the thought of going into a crowded room and having all those people next to me. You know, television was a big thing too, because, you know, you get home and then what you're watching on television, is completely, it's a completely different life. You know, that life over there that we lived, we thought, you know, that's real life. You know, it's life and death. It's the most important life that is going on right now. And we get over here and like the Kardashians are on and nobody's saying anything toward what's going on over there. So it kind of, it bursts your bubble a little bit. It's a lot to take in and you kind of have to get over. There's like an ego there when you get back, but you have to understand that the whole world is not on the same page.
Yeah, that I would think that among other things would be a huge adjustment to make because, yeah, when you're over there and you're in combat, just with the day-to-day existence and the perception of what's important, mm-hmm. and then coming back and, like you say, seeing the Kardashians or whatever, it's like, oh my God, that's a pretty jarring contrast.
It's just completely different, and you know, it's something that you have to get over. And if you can't get over, you should really try, because you know, I don't watch the Kardashians now, but I'm fine if I see them on TV. You know,
yeah, they don't bother you the way they did when you first came back.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's part of the transition. And again, I think sounds like a pivotal thing for you, as you've noted, was that 6 months transition rather than just coming right back home, which I think a lot of veterans have reported just what they were living and then what they are thrust into. That exacerbates all the things. I mean, you talk about crowded rooms. I think unease in crowds of one kind or another are very common, just general anxiety, et cetera. But I think all those things probably are exacerbated with no period to ease into that difference.
Absolutely.
So tell me about then how some of this led to or where the seedlings of the idea for One Last Treat started popping up.
Well, I guess with One Last Treat, I should start off. It was, you know, because it's an animal organization. And I should really start off by saying our first animal that we got. I found a pug. He was blind. He was deaf. He had his nails grown into his paw pads. And I found him on the streets of Detroit not too long after I got out of the military, probably about a year after I got out of the military. And at this point, I was still struggling. You know, a year out of the military, I was still kind of decompressing a little bit. And I found this dog, and it looked terrible. I thought I was going to have to take it to the shelter and put it down that day. But anyways, I found him, and he was an old dog, and we kept him for 3 months, and we gave him the best life we possibly could have. And I don't know, something called to me there, and I just realized that, you know, there's so many dogs out there like this. I mean, this was a dog that was owned by somebody. I knew that, but I didn't know who, and it was on the street, you know, Detroit, and you're almost wondering if somebody let it go or if they had the money to take care of it or whatnot. And that kind of called to me right there, because I found out now that there's a need. And I didn't know that before. I didn't know that there's a need for senior dogs,
mm-hmm.
you know? Yeah.
And so with that experience, is that, do you think, hey, there's probably more of these, like this blind deaf pug there that we've helped out? How did it go from there to thinking, hey, I really can and should do something maybe more formally?
Well, from there, I just, you know, I kind of came up with an idea of, hey, look, I want to do something. I want to continue, like, just doing something for the community or you know, really myself, and just bringing more things into the world where I can help people. I felt like I needed to do that. I was really, like I said, I was really struggling. So I called up my buddies. And I asked them, you know, if they would help me with some kind of animal organization. I want to do something with animals. And they said, heck yeah, we're on board. So from there, I just, you know, started developing a program where I can try to help senior dogs. Slowly, you know, started up. And I was still working. I actually moved to Scottsdale, Arizona. I was working at Yelp for a while. And while I was there, I was slowly chipping away at some kind of program and an idea that we can bring into the world. And that's where One Last Treat started. And we've been, you know, slowly going ever since. I think we got our 501c3 in March of 2016. Finally.
It is a relatively new organization.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess what happened is that with the experience with that pug, there was sort of, I guess, a light bulb moment of mm-hmm. I want to do something with animals. And in this case, I see the virtue of doing something with senior elderly animals that may be ailing. So how did it then from there become what, maybe you could describe actually probably better than I have so far on the show, what really One Last Treat is or does, and maybe along the way describe how you went from that pug to mm-hmm. kind of formulating the idea for what became One Last Treat.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, after I found the pug, I realized something to myself that I was very moved by it. You know what I mean? It called to me when I found this dog that I could help more dogs and that I wanted to help more dogs.
Yeah.
It was something I didn't feel. It felt very organic that I wanted to help this dog. So I knew that this is a path I had to take. So after that, like I say, I called up my buddies and we started working on a plan. And I knew I wanted to be where the dog was really. I mean, the mission of One Last Treat, the ultimate mission is to be there for animals while they're passed, before they leave this world. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? So it could be a dog that we rescue and have for a couple of years and just be there for their last moments. Or it could be a shelter dog. We want to go into shelters and provide that last little bit of love that some of these dogs might not have had prior to that. So once we got One Last Treat up and going, once we applied for 501c3, we started picking up dogs. We started, I call it a rescue out in California called Marley's Mutt, and we picked up a few dogs out in California. We developed a program. It was the 22 and 22 program where we teamed up with Marley's Mutt, Care Rescue LA, and a couple other rescues where we rescued 22 dogs in 22 days for veteran suicide. So, and then from there, it's just been slowly growing. And I came back to Michigan because I have a lot of support out here.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, we've just been picking up senior dogs and trying to place them with veterans. So it's a process that's sometimes slow and sometimes quick. It's a very new organization. It's a roller coaster at this point.
Well, let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Joel Rocky, Executive Director of One Last Treat, an organization consisting of military veterans who volunteer to look after dogs that are elderly, frail, or at the end of their lives. If you'd like to ask Joel a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So, first of all, just on a basic level, Joel, when you called up your buddies and then kind of got this rolling, and again, it's still early in the development overall, but can you sort of explain how the shared experience of military veterans felt that this was how they wanted to spend some of their time and energy? And maybe, you know, you mentioned a couple of times that you were struggling a year out, and so when this kind of idea first came to you, maybe how conscious you and others were of a mutual healing. I mean, these were older, frail dogs, some very ill, and you and I assume some of your buddies were struggling in one way or another, having gotten out of the service. So can you talk a little bit about how those things may connect?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess I would say, you know, when you first get out of the military, and I guess I'm speaking for James and Dre, obviously, as well. When we first get out of the military, you know, your whole mindset is that you were doing a very, very important job. You know, because that's exactly how you should feel when you're there. And when you get out, you're kind of knocked down a peg. You're not doing, you know, some of these guys are going to school or they start back up working at their job, and they don't feel as important as they did. And that's a very hard thing to take in, especially when you're, you know, still a young kid. And in some cases, even if you're not a young kid, just knowing that you're not doing or not being utilized to your full potential, is pretty rough. So when I called James and Dre up, they jumped on board, and I think they jumped on board just as quickly as I wanted to do it, just because you now had another mission. You had another goal in life, another something else to tackle, you know what I mean, that was not just about you. So, and a lot of guys, I feel, men and women, obviously, I feel, you know, are getting back, and they're looking for, you know, that mission. And they're not being asked. You know, you get out of the military, and a lot of people are handing a lot of these resources to you. And you know, we love our veterans here, and you can really go and find all kinds of programs that are going to help you out personally.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But you're not really being asked anymore to chip in a little bit
to serve.
We wanted to serve. So mm-hmm. we wanted to create something that, you know, we can get a veteran and be like, look, we need help. We need to get this animal out and into a, you know, a loving, caring home. Can you help us out? And if you do, hey, we'll pay for the medical cost. And I think what that does is let people know, especially veterans, that there still is a need for them. You know, they can provide a service, and we're an animal organization first. We're not a veteran organization. We have veterans come in and help the animal. We're not, we're not providing service to veterans. Veterans are providing service to the animals, and that's what the veterans like.
Yeah.
just to feel useful.
Well, in that way, I would say it would seem that the veterans are being provided a service. And as you say, I mean, one of the tough adjustments is, hey, we're not being asked to serve. We don't have that kind of important role that we once did. And this seems to be filling that void a bit.
Yeah, it's almost a different way to look about it, because we're not directly going out and saying, hey, we're trying to help veterans. But when somebody comes in and they take a dog from us, they're really helping themselves, you know what I mean, grow, you know, a little bit as a person and emotionally and whatnot.
Yeah.
You know, all we're doing is providing them animals. We help them out. They do the rest themselves. I mean, there's a great thing, you know, when you go out and you put some work in, and you go and volunteer, there's a reason people volunteer, you know, because you feel great after you do it. And if you're not being asked to volunteer, typically people won't usually just do it. So we want to, you know, we want to be an organization that asks, that because we need the help. So why not ask, and why not get these guys on another mission and another job?
If you could, Joel, walk me through a specific scenario or two of whether it's in Scottsdale where this began, or you're now in Michigan.
We're in Detroit where we're at now. There's a big need here.
Take me through like a specific dog and a specific veteran, whether it's you or one of your colleagues, and just sort of take us through what happens once you've identified, let's say, a dog or a family with a dog that might need the help of One Last Treat.
Yeah, so I'm going to probably go to my favorite one right now. It's Lonnie and Patty. So we picked up a dog here in Detroit. Her name is Patty. She was like a lab mix and in really rough shape. And she was a senior dog, so we knew that. And that's why we picked her up, obviously, because we only deal with seniors.
Yeah.
And she, you know, she was missing half of her hair on her body, very shy, very timid. We had no history on her, had no idea where she came from, if she was, you know, she wasn't a feral dog, so we didn't think she lived here on the street. So possibly she got loose from somebody at one point, but she was very, very timid and shy. And we had her for about a week or so, and I tried to, you know, I really tried to break through with her personally and see if I can develop any confidence in her, and I didn't really have too much success. But we found, we actually had a vet reach out to us. He was a Marine Corps veteran from Vietnam, and he wanted when he put on his application, we asked these people, why do you want the dog from The Last Treat? And he put on his application, he says, I need a friend. That's all he wrote. He said, I need a friend. And when I read that, I just knew that this guy needed, he needed a dog really bad. He needed somebody from us. So, and I felt like this was the perfect dog for him, because it was the case, you know, this dog is definitely not an easy dog to take in, because she was so shy and put off. So, you know, when we brought the dog to him, we let him know, look, this is a challenge. So you're going to have to put some work into it. And he was all for it. He loved it. He loved that he had to put some work into the dog. We're not just dropping off a dog that has, you know, it's completely potty trained and completely trained, knows how to sit and whatnot. I mean, these dogs, sometimes you don't know where they're coming from. So it's kind of a crapshoot. And he was all for it. You know, this is another task that this guy, you know, can complete. And remember, this is an older guy. So, you know, he's done, he's retired and whatnot. So he can spend his days, you know, training and teaching this old dog and making sure her life is the best it possibly can be for the next couple of years.
Yeah.
And I just got an update yesterday from him. He took her to the vet. Like I say, we pay for all medical care. So anything he ever needs for the animal, we take care of. He just calls us up and lets us know. And every time he calls us up and lets us know what she needs, he is extremely thorough, and he knows every little thing about this dog at this point. And that's exactly what we're going for. You know, these dogs need the love for the last couple of years. And like I said, like you were talking earlier, I guarantee Lonnie is definitely, you know, a better person today because of her. It's just a great thing to watch. So that's one of my favorite things right there.
For sure. Well, and again, I think it was, like you suggested, it was all kind of in the I need a friend part of his paperwork there that probably was everything you needed to know.
Yeah, it was, you know. He didn't, you know, you can apply. There's all kinds of service dogs out there, and he didn't apply for a service dog. He applied for an older senior dog, which tells me that he's probably a guy who doesn't feel like he needs a service dog. and that this was probably the best option for him because he really does feel like he's providing the service for the dog, and which he is.
Yeah. So a few questions, Joel, that kind of come to mind in the wake of that story. One is how, like, for example, with the gentleman you just mentioned and Patty, how, when you're able to look after some of their, like, say, veterinary costs or other costs, how is One Last Treat itself funded to be able to do that?
We're funded by donors. Mm-hmm. Like I say, we just got our 501c3 this year.
Yeah.
It does kind of cut us off to applying for grants right away because typically most grants want to see a history there. We're so new, so we're getting a lot of, most of our donors are finding us on Facebook. That's where I update people usually every single day about how the organization is going and moving forward and what our animals are up to and everything like that. So we find, people who are, we call them the treat team. These are people who watch us. Typically, they come in, check in a couple times a week, and they see us on Facebook. And if we need help with a specific animal, we let them know. And that's where our donations come in for medical care and other things that we might need.
And we should note that, yeah, you are on Facebook. You can just search for One Last Treat. And, of course, there is a website as well, onelasttreat.org, for people to find out more about that and ways they can help or get involved otherwise. So, and we'll talk about a few of those, of course, in our time here today, remaining time. But yeah. So I've got, a couple of emails that have come in. One says, from the years I spent in nursing homes supporting my mother, I came to realize that there were seniors who had to give up their dogs, and for a few of them, I actually believe that the grief shortened their lives. I have always wished that there was an organization that fostered these dogs and arranged for visits to their old owners. And she's asking if you're aware of any group like that.
You know what? I'm not 100% sure if I'm aware of a group specifically like that. I know there's an organization called Frost Spaces, and they do something similar, but I think that's actually after the owner passes, that they'll take care of the dog. Because I know that's a big thing. You know, when you're a senior yourself and you have a dog, that's huge. You're going to want to know where your dog's going, after you pass. I mean, that's just peace of mind. So I know there's a few organizations out there that do something like that. And it's absolutely incredible. Something maybe I would like to get into, down the road, open up a program like that. But I don't know personally if there's one specifically that will foster the dog and then bring him for visits and whatnot. But great idea, though.
So a few other questions here that have come in, and we'll get back to some of my own in a moment, though. But one says, Duncan, does the guest have a veterinarian consultant or other advisor?
No, we don't. We don't have a, like I said, we're still pretty new. I have a few friends, obviously, in the rescue industry that I can kind of bounce ideas off of when I'm talking about anything. Like we had to take a dog in for a dental surgery the other day. And I called one of my friends who takes in their dogs all the time, and I just asked them, what they typically do, and they kind of let me know. But that's something that we're going to be looking into in the future. We'd love to have somebody, on call that could just let us know. That's great with senior animals, and anytime we had an issue, we just call them up and, see what we should be doing for the animal.
Yeah, well, perhaps the person that wrote in either might offer their services or know someone
who could.
So
we'd love that. You could definitely email us at onelasttreat.org, and we'd like to chat.
Cool. So another question here says, Duncan, great guest and program. Please ask Joel how the 503 status helps One Last Treat other than tax-wise. Does it help with governmental program access?
It does. It absolutely does. Most grants and programs are going to want you to have that. It's another step of legitimacy, and it just makes you it makes you look good when you walk in the room and you have that. It looks like, you put your foot forward and you finally got your 501c3. It does help. When we're asking for donations anywhere, people are going to want to know that. A lot of people, when they're handing over, $25 for a donation or $50 for a donation, typically they don't care if it's a tax write-off or not, right? They're doing it because, they're part of the cause and the mission and they want to see change. But when you go in and you're asking for to get into a program or you're asking for a grant, for thousands of dollars, you're definitely going to need that.
Okay, so there's a few more questions, but I'm going to get back to a few of my own, including one thing that seems like it's come up a couple of times just since we've been talking, Joel, between the pug that kind of first sort of set things in motion, and then sounds like Patty as well. So being in the Detroit area, I mean, anybody that kind of cares about animals knows that in that area in particular, there is a large roaming population of dogs that don't otherwise have homes. How large a percentage are dogs in that situation figure into what One Last Treat does relative to going into shelters and other places?
You know, the difference with it was picking up roaming dogs as opposed to ones in the shelters is, you know, some of these dogs here in Detroit, you know, are feral dogs. They're dogs that really probably shouldn't be in a home, you know. And when we go to shelters, we do pick out, you know, if it's a senior dog, we don't want to get a feral dog and then put into somebody's home.
Yeah.
You know, because that's another case right there. There's other organizations that do that, but that takes a lot of work, and that's another path that we don't really want to go on right now.
Right.
So it's easier for us to go into the shelters and kind of vet them out like that. Because like I say, you can pick up a dog in Detroit. I mean, if you can catch the dog.
Yeah.
And it could be a dog that was born in the streets, you know, 100% of its life it's lived in the streets. And that's not really a dog that is ideal for a home. Some succeed, but in the majority of the cases, you know, they'll escape and they'll go right back to the streets again. So rather just, you know, let the shelters and whatnot, animal control, do their job, and we'll come into the shelters and pick them up from there.
That was kind of my understanding, really, about more how One Last Treat worked, but it just seems like between the pug story and the Patty story, it seemed like there was sort of a disproportionate number that were from the streets. So I just wanted to kind of clarify that. Here's something else that I wanted to talk to you about, because I know we all would feel that euthanasia is never really a great topic, but my understanding is that some of One Last Treat's efforts are directly tied to animals that are facing euthanasia. Yeah. So how so, and maybe explain how that works a bit.
The one thing with One Last Treat is that we kind of come into there's an understanding, and this is why I think possibly by being veterans we kind of understand it a little bit more, is that, you know, the fact of the matter is you can't save them all. You know, you can try to save every single animal. The fact is some of them are too far gone, and you know, we come in with the mentality of understanding that and just trying to make their life the best as possible before, you know, the owner's going to have to say goodbye or we're going to have to say goodbye. And just looking at it realistically, you know, you get a lot of people who can't deal with the fact that these animals have to be, you know, that they're suffering and by putting them out and going through euthanasia is that is the best possible cause for them, the best possible route. So, like I say, we will come in there and just kind of be that voice of understanding and look at it realistically and, you know, support. You know, if we find a dog that doesn't have an owner, we'll get together and we'll look at it with veterinarians and just kind of come up with a game plan. But we definitely understand that you can't save them all. A lot of these animals are too far gone. A lot of these animals that are dropped off at the shelters, you know, some people can't afford to put them down themselves, especially in poor areas like Detroit. And when they drop them off in the shelter and they're suffering, the shelter has to, you know, they have to put them down. And in my opinion, I guess that's something that we don't like to see. I mean, it's like somebody is now taking over, you know, your duty. You know, if you have an animal, you should be there for their final moments. No, so we want to definitely make sure that people are doing that. So we'll cover financial costs for that too, and we'll come and we'll be there. We'll transport you anywhere you need to go. We'll transport you, and like I say, try to make that animal's final moments the best they possibly can, because fact of the matter is everyone has time.
So part of that then, if I follow you, Joel, is that people that do have animals but maybe don't have the resources to care for that animal, including up through and including, I guess, the euthanasia itself, you will step in and help these people with the costs and emotional support, or at least free them up on some of those so that they can provide the emotional support to their animal that has maybe reached the end of their life.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, we don't want to see anybody giving up their animal in the final moment to have somebody else, you know, to have the animal sit in the shelter on a hold for a few days, only just to be put down because they have to be put down, you know?
Yeah.
We don't want to see that. That's terrible for the animal. It's terrible for the owner too. I mean, there's a lot of stress in dropping an animal off and not knowing what's happening and whatnot. So, I mean, it's terrible for everybody. So yes, we will. If you contact us, we will come out. Like I say, we're in Detroit right now. We'll come out really anywhere in Michigan. If you need the help, we will come out and schedule a day to, you know, say goodbye to your animal, and we'll be there and whatnot. And we'll pay for for all costs.
And Joel, well, you and I guess some of the operations is based in Detroit. Am I not right in thinking that there's still other One Last Treat services that could be provided elsewhere in the country, whether it's Scottsdale, where at least the initial effort may have begun, or just where some of the volunteer veterans happen to reside?
Yeah, we have. So right now, we're kind of at the point of where we're trying to figure out how to build programs that are going to be able to last in specific communities without, you know, actually being there. So we are looking for people, you know, veterans, volunteers, really anybody who wants to, who kind of likes the mission and wants to help out, to help us out in different cities and whatnot. Because these are programs you absolutely can do. It doesn't have to be specific to one location. These are things you can do all across the country, really. But the biggest thing right now is just developing programs that people are going to be able to use in different cities. So, right now we're in Detroit. We'd love to have a little bit more pull in different cities, but that's going to be something for the future.
I got you. All right, Joel, we're sort of nearing the end of our time. I just want to work in one quick call. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Joel Rocky from One Last Treat. We just have a brief time left here for a quick question, please.
Hi, I just wanted to say what a wonderful service that this is. And as somebody that adopts older dogs myself, I've had that full Marley and me experience a few times where actually the dog was euthanized in my home with my children in a familiar surrounding and with the people that love them. And this is a wonderful, wonderful service. And I really think that people ought to consider giving, even if you don't have an animal that's old and infirmed and needs to be euthanized now or needs to be adopted now. At some point in your life, you may. And if at that point you don't have the resources to have your animal taken care of the right way, your support to an organization like this now can make sure it's there in a time where you may need it or the time when someone you care about may need it. So as the holidays approach, you're going to hear a lot of different pleas for help for a lot of different organizations. But those of us that really love animals really need to dig deep into their pockets now and maybe spend a little bit less on presents this year and send what you can to an organization like this so that they have resources this year, the next year. And to take a look at their 990 forms, see how they spend their money, become comfortable with it, and maybe even consider cutting the IRS out of your will and making sure that these people have the resources to continue this wonderful mission.
Well, that's really great, sir. Thank you very much. And that kind of, to me, constitutes the perfect point at which to wrap things up very nicely. So we've been speaking with Joel Rocky, Executive Director of One Last Treat. Again, you can go on Facebook and just search for One Last Treat and find their active Facebook page there. There also is a website, onelasttreat.org, to find out more, to get involved, to help out in one way or another if you'd like to. So, Joel, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals, and good luck with the continued development of One Last Treat.
Yeah, absolutely, Duncan. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. In a few moments, I'll speak with Sue Pike, a.k.a. the Animal Talker, about her visit to Tampa, including joining E-Love on ultrasounds here on WMNF tomorrow night, as well as doing Reiki sessions, pet readings, and more around town. Right now, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner. This is Sean Donnelly with a piece called I Love My Bulldog in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
I kind of have a kid now. We have an English Bulldog. Do you guys know what that is? English Bulldog? Yeah. If you don't know what an English Bulldog is, those are dogs that are really fat and they're low to the ground. They have breathing problems. They go... Arr. I just got the dog version of myself. That's basically it. I just wanted something else unhealthier than me in my house. I don't know if you know this, but Bulldogs, English Bulldogs, they're very stubborn dogs. Did you know that? They like to pull you when you want them. And I spend all day with my dog, so sometimes I forget my dog's a dog, and I talk to him like he's a human. You've ever been a dog? You know what I'm talking about? And the other day, I'm walking him, and he's pulling me, and I get so upset. And out of nowhere, I just yell, and I go, you think you call the shots? Well, you don't. I call the shots. And then he pooped. And then I picked it up. I was like, all right, you definitely call the shots. If you're in a relationship with somebody and you pick up their poop, they call the shots in that relationship. I love my dog so much. I wish he was human. He'd be the coolest guy in the world if he was human. He'd be the kind of guy, he'd crash his car, he wouldn't, you know what I'm saying? Do you know how many times I've hit my dog in the head with a door? And he's just like, yeah, it's totally cool. Don't worry about it. I love you. Let's go do something else. We'll go to a diner. I don't care. I love you. It's me and you. You can't do that with cats. Let's face it, everybody. Cats are dicks, okay? It's true. Cats are dicks. I hate cats. Yeah. If cats were human, they would just be like your really uptight, skinny friend, Beth. That you can't say the word moist around, you know what I'm saying? That's why you have cat people. You need cat people. There's only two types of people in this world, cat people and gun people. Because a lot of people don't like those two things. There's no other animal that has a group of people associated with it. There's no lizard ladies. Right? There's no lonely women in their apartments with lizards knitted on their sweaters. Also, why is that? Why is the cat the symbol animal for the lonely woman? So everywhere in the world's ignoring you, so you get the one animal in the world to ignore you as well?
That was Sean Donnelly with a piece called I Love My Bulldog, taken from his CD, Manual Labor Face. Now let's move to my brief conversation with Sue Pike, Reiki master and animal communicator, about what all she's doing while she's in Tampa the next few days. Let's welcome Sue Pike back to Talk Animals. Good morning, Sue.
Hello, Duncan. Thank you for having me on.
You bet. So let's start with a few quick basics. When we say Reiki master, what do we mean?
That means I teach people how to do Reiki. I attune them to the energy of Reiki. And Reiki is a Japanese healing technique. Rei meaning universal life force energy, and Ki is your Chi, prana, life force. And as a Reiki practitioner, we just bring that beautiful love energy to you, and your body does its own healing.
And while we're at it, what do we mean when we say animal communicator?
So as an animal communicator, I can telepathically communicate with all animals. So that means I can hear, feel, see what they're thinking and feeling and tell their human whatever the animal wants them to know.
Wow. And I think we should note that that can be animals that are no longer with us, as
yes,
well as animals that are across from us in the living room or wherever they might be.
Exactly. And it's always fascinating to connect to the animals that are what I like to call spirit form, because they're all doing different things. I mean, some are just relaxing and chilling out, and some are teaching, and some are helping others cross. It's very fascinating.
So fans of ELUB's great show Ultrasounds, yes, know you're a monthly guest on that great show, and you will return tomorrow night. So for those who haven't had a chance to hear those visits, describe what you and ELUB do on those occasions.
Sure. So I will be live at the studio with her at WM&F tomorrow, and 10 p.m. to midnight on the Ultrasound show. And what I do prior to the show is I meditate. That's how I prepare for it. And I ask what animals or animal realms have messages for all of us for our highest good. And then on the show, I go through all the messages from whatever animal appears to me in my meditation with all these fabulous, very profound, lots of times, messages for all of us, for everybody, for our highest good and the planet's highest good.
Wow. So that's, I guess, why they call you the animal talker. And, of course, would be of great interest to people listening to a show called Talking Animals. It all connects very nicely there.
Yeah, so definitely.
Otherwise, I think you're in town for a number of Reiki sessions and pet readings.
Yes.
Let's talk for a quick moment about those. When we say pet readings, are that basically kind of what you've already described for people who just want to keep their terms?
I mean, animal communication sometimes confuses people, so I just say pet readings. But I wanted to mention really quickly before that is, by the way, ELUB actually is going to be performing and speaking at the Unity Church in New Port Richey this Sunday at 10:30. So if anybody's interested, they can go to portrichey.org for all the details.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So come support and listen. She's beautiful, beautiful performer. Yeah. So, I have one Reiki healing session left on Friday at 4 p.m. All the other ones are booked. And I do regular Reiki, but I also do Reiki Extra, which is regular Reiki plus other energy work if guided, crystal therapy, and channeled messages for your highest good, related to your healing. And I said, I have one of those left on Friday. And actually, you know, animals love when we're relaxed, they're relaxed. So it's like a win-win situation. And then the pet readings I'm doing Monday and Tuesday. And I believe I have one or two spots left. I'm not booking those. Somebody else is doing that for me. But okay. I heard yesterday I have, I think, one or two spots left. So if you're interested, you could go to my blog, which is animalchanneler.blogspot.com, and it says where everything is, who to contact, and all that stuff. But if you don't want to do that, and you're just like, I just want to email Sue to get information, they could do that. My email is reikisue@gmail.com.
Great, and we'll get one more time. They want to find kind of the whole bit of information laid out that we've sort of been touching on here. So it's animalchanneler.blogspot.com to find all the details of your the next few days.
Yeah, C-H-A-N-N-E-L-E-R, Animal Channeler.
Right.
Yeah, and the pet readings, you can bring your animal, or if they're afraid to travel or they don't like to travel, please don't bring them. You can actually just bring a printed picture of your animal, either alive or in spirit form, and I can do the session with that. I can also offer Reiki to your animal, too.
We got everything. We got you covered every which way. So, Sue, we're sort of unfortunately out of time, but at least people now know how to reach you or to find out kind of what's still available in your visit this time around. And so thanks so much for joining us on Talk Animals, and have a great few days in town.
Thank you so much, Duncan.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity. Rolling into the new hour, constitutes a full 2 hours of interviews, phone calls, news, and more with contributions from members of the stellar WNF staff, including, of course, Everyday Ethics with Craig Kopp. Meanwhile, it's the prize for Name of the Animal Team. I'll be offering a Talking Animals t-shirt right now. We're going to hit a couple quick animal news and announcements, including that this Saturday, November 5th, at Yuengling Brewery in Tampa, there's a big adoption event and shots under the auspices of the Humane Society of Tampa Bay that, let's just say, could not be more reasonably priced. We're not ever allowed to talk about the price or cost of things on the air here, as you probably know by now. But anyways, there's going to be 8 rescue groups and all kinds of food trucks, vendors, giveaways. But the shots and the rest of the adoption opportunities are pretty great there. Then the next day, of course, we've got Stride for Strays. That's, again, November 6th at Perry Harvey Senior Park. So you can go to actampa.org or strideforstrays.org to find out the details there. And further down the road, we've got the Tampa Bay Veg Fest coming up November 12th. That's probably all we have time for. So we're going to try to hold off, I think, on today's edition of Name That Animal Tune. And one more thing coming up, because it involves an author that was on this show a while back. Laura Coffey, who's the author of My Old Dog, Rescue Pets with Remarkable Second Acts. Again, she was on Talking Animals talking about her book, which kind of touts the virtues. Adopting senior dogs, sort of what we were talking about with Joel a little bit. And some families who've done so. Great, great book. Nico Case loves the book and wrote the foreword for it. Anyway, she will be in town coming up at the Tampa Bay Times Festival reading November 12th. And she'll also have a book signing, dog adoption literature event at the Clearwater Barnes & Nobles on November 13th. So I think that's all we have time for today. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. NPR News coming up.